be met? What tools can you use to learn how to ask? Practice communicating directly. When you ask for something, make sure you're actually asking. There is a difference between, I want to go to bed now. Do you want to go to bed now? Are you coming to bed? I would like you to come to bed now. And I would like your attention now. Be precise. Communicating directly may feel awkward at first, and you might not be good at it. That's okay. These are skills, and skills take practice. Talk about what you actually want, not what you think you should want, or what you think might be available. Check your assumptions. If you think you heard implied criticism that was not stated directly, ask if that was what was intended. If not, you may be using passive communication. This is especially true when someone says something like, I don't want that, or I don't need that. A person habituated to passive communication may hear, and therefore, you shouldn't want or need that either, when the person was actually just talking about herself. Assume good intent. Your partners are with you because they love you and want to be with you, even when problems arise, needs are being met, or communication goes awry. This is still true. If you start with the assumption that your partners are acting out of malice, communication is never going to recover. When a partner has done the work of asking clearly for what she needs, take it seriously. Even small requests can be very hard to make, and they can lie at the tip of some very big emotions. If you can't meet the request, at least acknowledge it by saying no, and preferably explain why. If you can't do what your partner is asking, inquire about the underlying need. Is there another way of meeting it? No, I can't be with you next Thursday, but is there another time when I can help support you? Is better than just no. Talk about the reasons. As scary as it can be to advocate for our needs, it can be even scarier to talk about why we want or need the things we want or need. Talking about the reasons leaves us naked. It opens us up to having our reasons or even our motives questioned. It also requires that we look inside ourselves and think about why we want what we want. This can be difficult. Because I just don't want that is not good communication. If we ask for something, especially something that places limits on someone else's behavior, and most especially if it affects more people than just you and your partner, we need to talk about the why as well as the what. This more effectively advocates for our needs, and it opens the door for a genuine dialogue in how to have them met. Sometimes things that trigger us are hidden inside the statement. I just don't want that. For example, some people, usually heterosexual men, approach polyamory with the idea that it's okay if their partners have other female lovers, but feel threatened if their partners have other male lovers. It's certainly easier to say, I just don't want my partner to have sex with another man, than to admit feelings of vulnerability around sex, perhaps because you're afraid that if another man does what you do, you might be replaced. Talking about triggers is necessary if we are to understand why we feel the way we do, and understanding our feelings is the only way to grow. The purpose of talking about the things that trigger us is not to make our partners avoid them, but to better understand them. When we can make sense of our emotional responses, we can more easily take responsibility for them, rather than making our partners, or worse yet, our partner's partners, responsible for them. If, for example, you feel threatened by your lover having sex with another man, talking about why and owning that feeling can help you become more secure in your relationship. Discussing how you feel gives your partner an opportunity to explain what value she sees in you, and why another man doesn't have to be threatening to you. I just don't want that, tends to end rather than continue conversations. We encourage continuing discussion about what you want, and more importantly, why. By triggers, we mean specific thoughts, actions, sights, or events that set off an emotion that may not actually be related to the current situation, or may be much more powerful than the circumstances would seem to warrant. A trigger is usually tied to an earlier experience and may be connected to a traumatic event. Cut through the fog. Being polyamorous doesn't convey immunity to negative feelings. Polyfolks experience jealousy, insecurity, doubt, and the full range of other human emotions. If we waited for immunity to uncomfortable emotions before traveling this road, we'd never budge. What's necessary is simply to understand that we don't have to put our emotions in the driver's seat. We feel what we feel. The secret is to understand that we still have power, even in the face of our feelings. We can still choose to act with courage, compassion, and grace, even when we're terrified, uncertain, and insecure. The notion that we can control our actions despite our emotions seems radical to many. The first part of making it happen is just realizing it's possible. Once you've turned that corner, given all the social messages saying we're helpless in the face of our emotions, that's a tough thing to do. The rest is practice. Some guidelines that help prevent you from turning over the wheel to your emotions. Understand that your emotions often lie to you. Feelings aren't fact. It's possible to feel threatened when there is no threat, for example, or feel powerless when you aren't. Avoid making decisions, especially irrevocable, life-altering decisions, when in the grip of strong emotions. Try not to validate, suppress, hang on to, or deny your emotions. Just feel them. Understand what they're trying to say, and then let them pass. Emotions are like weather. They come and go. Don't tell yourself you shouldn't feel them, but don't keep rehearsing things that keep them alive either. Acknowledge them and let them go. Learn how you best process your emotions, and then advocate for doing that. Some people process their emotions by talking about them immediately. Others need to withdraw a while. Both approaches work for different people. If you need to say, "I don't want to go to bed angry. I would really like to talk about this now," say so. If you need to say, "Look, I can't talk about this right now. Let's come back to it in the morning," do that. Take a deep breath from time to time and remind yourself that your lover is your partner, not the enemy. Enemies fight. Partners work together toward a common good. Remember, this too shall pass. Our emotions tend to color our perceptions of the past and future. When we're happy, we remember times in the past when we've been happy and more easily see future happiness. When we're angry or frightened, we recreate our past and future accordingly. But emotions are transient. The things we feel today won't be what we feel tomorrow. Be curious. Many conflicts arise because we've made judgments without full knowledge of the thoughts or feelings behind another person's actions. If the two, or more, sides in a conflict work from their own assumptions without checking whether these are true, no one feels understood. All become even more hurt and angry, and the conflict escalates. Many conflict resolution professionals stress the value of curiosity, accompanied by active listening. Many conflicts can be avoided or de-escalated if the parties involved are willing to set aside their prejudgments and the intense feelings connected to them and ask a question, and then be curious about the actual answer. Not just any question, though. The question should be genuine and open-ended. A serious request for more information about another person's feelings, intentions, or motivations. It should not be a choice between predefined alternatives or accusation followed by a demand for a response. It should be, as much as possible, unburdened from what you think will be the answer. That means being curious about what it really is. Consider the following questions arising from the same scenario. When we went to that dinner party, you didn't sit next to me. Obviously, you're ashamed to be seeing me. Why are you even involved with me if you don't want people to know we're together? Could you tell me why you chose that particular seat at the party? They both end with a question mark, but they are very different kinds of questions. One is a barely veiled accusation and expression of hurt. The other is a genuine request for information. The answer could turn out to be anything from, "I wanted to talk to Bill over there about his project," or, "Honestly, I'm worried that if the boss sees me with you, he'll think I'm cheating on my wife." Once the questioner understands where his partner is coming from, she will be able to respond to the situation using accurate information, not just her own stories. And she will stand a better chance of being able to express her own feelings about the situation to her partner without putting words in his mouth or putting him on the defensive, because he will know that she understands where he is coming from. Moving away from defensiveness, assumptions, and judgments, and towards curiosity requires us to step outside ourselves. And that involves recognizing that the world may not be exactly as we think it is. We may have been wrong about our assessment of other people. It can be hard to restrain our emotional responses for long enough to express curiosity and try to understand the feelings of the very person we believe is responsible for our pain. But it can diffuse a lot of conflicts before they start. Don't let the dishes get crusty. Good communication is not just reactive, but proactive. That means regular checking in just to see how things are going, and not just with your partners, but with yourself. Talk about things that bother you while they're still small. Express what you want early and often. Don't sit on things hoping they'll go away. Don't wait until someone raises a specific problem before talking. Develop the habit of letting your partners know where you're at emotionally and on an ongoing basis. The purpose of checking in is simply to keep the lines of communication open, so problems can be spotted when they're still ripples rather than tsunamis. Noel Lynn Figart, the author of the blog The Polyamorous Misanthrope, calls this not letting the dishes get crusty. When everyone makes it a habit to wash the dishes as soon as they use them, rather than letting them pile up, no one has to confront the icky task of washing an entire sink full of crusty 3-day-old dishes. Healthy self-expression. Talking about our needs and feelings is tougher when we fear that we might come across as controlling, that is, dictating what another person should do. In a desire not to be seen as controlling, we may say nothing at all, which can let problems grow until we feel we have no choice but to blurt controllingly, "I want you to stop what you're doing right now." If you're used to passive communication, expressing a feeling can seem the same as being controlling. One of Franklin's partners grew up in a household where every statement of "I feel thus and such" contained an implicit, "and it's your responsibility to do something about it." If you don't want to be seen as manipulative and controlling, and you don't, right? Expressing yourself can feel dangerous, because it might be perceived that way. The difference between expressing and controlling is in your expectations. What do you expect your partner to do? Is your goal to express your feelings or to change your partner's behavior? Just as the difference between asking and demanding lies in whether you can accept a no, the difference between expressing a feeling and being controlling is in whether it's okay for your partner to continue her present course of action. Are you demanding, or are you informing and negotiating? While it may sound obvious, the simplest way to make your intention clear is to talk about it. You might say, for example, "I'm not telling you not to go on your date this Saturday, but I wanted to let you know I'm feeling some anxiety about it." From there, you can talk about the anxiety and possibly even suggest ways that your partner can be supportive to you. For example, "I would like to connect with you after you get home," or "I'd like to set aside some special time with you on Friday before you go." Direct communication heads off passive assumptions about passive communication. If you are negotiating, make that plain too. For example, you might say, "I'm feeling anxious about your date on Saturday. We're taking the dog to the vet that morning, and I might need your help taking care of him Saturday evening. Is it possible for you to reschedule for Friday instead?" Keep in mind, though, that sometimes the answer might be no, and that doesn't necessarily mean your partner doesn't care about you or your feelings. She may have a schedule problem of her own. Making communication safe. There's one more prerequisite for communication to succeed. It has to be safe for another person to communicate with you. We all want our partners to be honest with us. At the same time, nobody likes to hear bad news. From ancient empires to modern boardrooms, bearers of bad tidings have paid the price for delivering messages distastefully to the recipient's ears. Even in ordinary day-to-day conversations, there are all kinds of ways we can make it dangerous for others to say what we don't want to hear. Adria's story. Adria, a friend of Franklin's, had been dating her boyfriend for 2 years and wanted to get married. One day, her boyfriend came to her and said he had something to ask her. Adria was elated because she was sure he was going to propose. She said, "You can ask me anything you want." Her heart sank when he didn't propose. Instead, he asked if they could try some new sexual things, like light bondage and spanking. Adria was hurt that he wasn't proposing, and also angry and hurt that he was asking to try these new things. She thought he was dissatisfied with her. She felt like he was saying she was a boring lover, because he couldn't enjoy regular sex with her. She yelled at him and told him he was a pervert and said he was telling her she was bad in bed. He broke up with her shortly after that. Adria's story contains a couple of lessons. The most immediate is that if you tell your partner it's okay to ask for anything you want, it better be true. If you're not prepared to make it safe for your partner to open up to you, he won't, because he'll feel he can't. We don't always yell at people who say something we don't like to hear, but we often forget how many ways we can make it very expensive for people to be honest with us. When we love someone, it's hard, even under the best of circumstances, to say something that will make them unhappy. It requires a lot of vulnerability and courage to do that. We expose ourselves emotionally because our partner's feelings affect ours. When that vulnerability is met with defensiveness, annoyance, passive aggressiveness, silence, anger, or resentment, honesty becomes damn near impossible. If we want our lovers to be honest with us, we have to make it safe for them to be honest. We need to accept what we hear without anger, recriminations, or blame, even when we're surprised or we hear something we really don't want to. We must be willing to take a deep breath, switch gears, and say, "Thank you for sharing that with me." Handling mistakes. Things will go wrong. You and your partners will make mistakes. People will get hurt. To paraphrase Voltaire, we are all born of frailty and error. What happens afterward depends on how capable we are to forgive one another for our errors, handle the consequences with grace and dignity, and learn from our mistakes. Mistakes happen because someone is trying to solve a problem or meet a need. It's easy, in the emotional aftermath, to see the mistake as a consequence of selfishness or some other moral failing. But recovery from a mistake depends on being able to see our partners as human beings doing their best to solve a problem, rather than as caricatures or monsters. Compassion, like communication, is one of those things that's most valuable when it's most difficult. This kind of compassion is also needed when you're the one who makes a mistake. Sometimes it's easier to treat others with gentleness or compassion than do the same for ourselves. We recognize the fallibility of those around us more readily than our own. You will make mistakes. It's the cost of being human. When you do, look at them as opportunities to learn, and remember that compassion begins at home. Questions to ask yourself. Strategies for better communication include, for starters, active listening, direct communication, and non-violent communication. As you practice these skills on a daily basis in your relationships, here are some questions to keep you on track. How directly do I ask for what I want and need? What can I do to be more direct in my communication? If I hear a hidden meaning in a statement or question, do I ask for clarification before acting on my assumptions? Do I perceive criticism in my partner's statements, even if they aren't directly critical? What do I do to check in with my partners? How well do I listen to my partners? What do I do to make sure it's safe for my partners to communicate with me and let them know it's safe? Does my communication show that I take responsibility for my actions and emotions? 8. Taming the Green-Eyed Monster. The worst thing about jealousy is how low it makes you reach. Erica Young. So you're finally in a polyamorous relationship. You're involved with someone who has another partner. There you are, cruising along, and wham! You see something, or hear something, or think about something, and now you're in the thick of it. Jealousy. It happens, sometimes when we least expect it. When it does, we can feel like we want to set fire to the world before running into a dark cave screaming, "I will never let anyone get close to me ever again!" Or maybe that's just us. We give such talismanic power to jealousy that the fear of it alone can shape our relationships. We've never heard anyone say, "Polyamory? I wouldn't want to do that. What if I feel angry?" Or, "What if I feel sad?" But many people say, "Polyamory? What if I feel jealous?" The fact is, at some point, you will. Few people are born immune to jealousy. The good news is, jealousy is just an emotion like any other emotion. Sometimes you feel sad. Sometimes you feel angry. But you don't let those feelings define you. They don't run your life. Jealousy doesn't need to either. What is jealousy? Jealousy is the feeling we get when we drag tomorrow's rain cloud over today's sunshine. It's the feeling that we are about to lose something important to us, including maybe our self-worth, to someone else. It's the fear that we aren't good enough, that the people around us don't really love us, that everything is about to turn to ash. It comes like a thief in the night, stealing our joy. Jealousy is a sneaky thing. It sits behind us, whispering that we are the victim, not the villain, that the people around us are wronging us, and we must act to protect ourselves. And perhaps most destructively, it tells us not to talk openly about the way we're feeling. It thrives on secrecy and silence. At its most toxic, it makes us angry at others and ashamed of ourselves at the same time. Jealousy wears many faces because, unlike surprise or fear or anger, it is built of many emotions. Insecurity, fear of loss, territoriality, inadequacy, poor self-esteem, fear of abandonment. All these can pile onto one another to make what we think of as jealousy. Is jealousy an intrinsic part of human nature? Some folks say yes, some no. We say, it doesn't matter. We feel what we feel, but there is a difference between jealous feelings and jealous actions. Regardless of the origin of jealous feelings, the actions we take are within our control. Jealous feelings come from a sense of loss or of a fear of it. Jealous actions are usually attempts to take back control over the thing we're afraid of. For example, if you feel jealous when your partner has sex with her new partner in the monkey with lotus blossom and chainsaw position, you might be afraid that you're losing something special. That's our position! What if this new person handles the chainsaw better than I do? What does she need me for now that she's found someone else to do this with? The jealous action might be to say, I don't want you to have sex with anyone but me in this position, which is an attempt to deal with fear by taking back control. If she stops doing this, I won't feel replaced anymore, at least until the next threatening thing comes along. These kinds of actions don't create safety or security. Rather, safety and security come from knowing that your partner loves, trusts, and values you. Putting controls on your partner's behavior doesn't tell you how she loves, trusts, and values you. It does exactly the opposite. Restriction undermines intimacy by telling your partner that you don't trust her. You don't believe her affection is genuine. The chameleon emotion. Sometimes jealousy can be a relatively simple emotion, easy to detect and recognize. This is especially true when it happens in response to clear triggers, like watching a partner kiss another partner. The first time Eve saw Peter holding hands with Cleo, the lurching feeling of the ground dropping out from beneath her feet was an unmistakable sign of jealousy. It was impossible to interpret as anything else, and the stimulus responsible for it was clear. That made the feeling, as scary as it was, relatively straightforward to confront. But one of the things that can make jealousy such a challenge is that it's a shapeshifter. Jealousy masquerades as other emotions. Before you can fight it, you need to see it for what it is. Some of the emotions that can have jealousy at their root are fear, loneliness, loss, sadness, anger, betrayal, envy, and humiliation. If you are feeling these in connection to one of your partners or metamors, and there's no obvious reason, or if the emotion is much stronger than the situation would seem to warrant, ask yourself if it might be jealousy. On the other hand, those same emotions can arise in response to a genuinely hurtful external situation. In those cases, it can be too easy to blame jealousy and duck the real issues. It's reasonable to ask yourself, am I really having these emotions just because I'm feeling jealous? Take heed if someone frequently minimizes your emotions as just jealousy. Do you feel you're being listened to? Are you being offered genuine insight about yourself by someone who knows and cares about you? Or are you being belittled and dismissed? Jealousy can be a valuable signal that we have some soul-searching to do. Managing jealousy means having enough insight to tell it apart from its imposter emotions, and vice versa, as well as from external problems that may be developing. Distinguishing it from its lookalikes means knowing yourself. Triggers for jealousy. Sometimes jealousy is triggered by public behavior we often associate with couplehood, holding hands in public, sending flowers to a partner's workplace, meeting a partner's parents. Peter felt jealous when Eve started wearing a gold necklace Ray had given her, and Eve felt jealous when Cleo posted a picture on Facebook of a necklace Peter had made for her. As we discuss in Chapter 18 on mono-poly relationships, Celeste felt jealous when Franklin's partner Bella wanted to have portraits taken with him, as did Mila when Metamore Nina posted family portraits to Facebook that included their partner, Morgan. These triggers usually happen when we fear losing the social status that comes from being part of a couple. In polyamorous relationships, such a loss is probably inevitable. Poly relationships, by definition, include more than a couple. These triggers can often be avoided by using strategies we talk about in the mono-poly chapter, such as including everyone in a family portrait. It also helps to demonstrate that you are not a victim or a pawn, but a full participant in the poly relationship. For example, if you're feeling jealous about your partner's new sweetie meeting his parents, scheduling the meeting when you can also be there will show his parents that it's not happening behind your back. As mentioned, a common trigger for jealousy is seeing your partner being physically affectionate or flirty with someone else. This can bring up fears of being replaced or activate the "why am I not enough" script. It can also lead to destructive comparison with your partner's other partner. Is she sexier than I am? Prettier? Smarter? Better? Physical evidence of intimacy between your partner and another lover, like a condom wrapper in the trash or extra slippers at the foot of the bed, can trigger jealous feelings. So can seeing your partner do something for the first time with a new lover, the sushi effect mentioned in Chapter 5. Sometimes all it takes to deal with these triggers is to recognize the feeling for what they are and say, "I'm feeling jealous, because it seems like I'm learning to understand I'm not your only partner. Please, bear with me while I work through this." Sometimes handling these triggers is more complicated, and we talk about more strategies in a bit. Listening to jealousy. People often think of jealousy as evil. It can certainly make people do evil things, but itself, jealousy is morally neutral, like all emotions. It is the way the ancient, reptilian parts of our brains, parts that don't have language, try to communicate with us. The problem is that, as communicators go, jealousy is pretty inarticulate. It might be pointing to a significant problem in a relationship, or it might just be our inner wordless 3-year-old stomping its foot and saying, "I'm not getting everything I want." It might also be a symptom of a weak spot within us, some insecurity or self-doubt we're trying to protect. We have to decode the message if we are to decide what to do about it. We can be tempted to approach jealousy by blaming whatever triggered it. It's so simple. Just stop holding hands with your other partner. We can also mistake it for other things like territoriality or possessiveness or something else entirely. And sometimes that's what it is. We'll get to that in a bit. Here is Franklin's story.
Ruby was smart, beautiful, strong, outgoing, opinionated, just the sort of person I find irresistible, and one of my first partners during my relationship with Celeste. I was just out of school, and up to that point, I'd never experienced jealousy. I'd had partners who had had other partners, and I'd never had even a twinge of bad feeling about it. I naively, and somewhat arrogantly, believed I was immune to jealousy, that it was something other people experienced, but not me. I was utterly smitten with Ruby. Our relationship was emotional wildfire. Unfortunately, the terms of my agreement with Celeste didn't really permit a close, bonded relationship, which is exactly the kind of relationship Ruby and I were emotionally drawn into. We both chafed under the restrictions. No overnight stays, no public affection, a strict ceiling on how far the relationship would ever be allowed to grow. We both understood at some level that our relationship would never be permitted to become what we both needed it to be. Before long, Ruby started another relationship with a close friend of mine, Newton. He was an excellent choice as a partner for her, quick-witted, laid-back, good-natured. His relationship with Ruby had no ceiling and no restrictions. Instinctively, I knew that Newton could offer Ruby more than I could, and I was terrified that he would replace me in Ruby's heart. The jealousy happened so fast and hit me so hard that I couldn't even recognize it for what it was. All I knew was that when I saw them together, I felt scared and angry. I assumed that because I felt this way, she must be doing something wrong, though it was difficult for me to figure out exactly what. I remember going to sleep replaying all of my interactions with her in my head, looking for that thing she was doing to hurt me so much. Because I was starting from the premise that she was doing something wrong, why else would I be feeling so bad? I lashed out at her, accusing her of all kinds of wrongdoing, most of which existed only in my head. The tiniest, most trivial things she said or did that I didn't agree with were magnified to epic proportions. Before long, unsurprisingly, I had destroyed my relationship with Ruby, and not long after that, my friendship with her, and with Newton, as well. Not until more than a year later did I finally put together what had happened. By the time I realized I was jealous, and that I had allowed my jealousy to poison our relationship, it was too late. I had done so much damage that neither Ruby nor Newton ever spoke to me again. I lost a partner and two friends.
Franklin destroyed his relationship with Ruby because he was unable to conceive that he might feel jealousy, and therefore he was unable to listen to it. In this case, the jealousy was saying, you are encumbered by rules and constraints specifically intended to prevent you from having the kind of relationship both of you need. Newton is able to offer her a relationship without limits. If she wants that kind of relationship, you might be replaced. Was Franklin actually in danger of being replaced? No. Ruby loved him very much. How might listening to the jealousy have changed the outcome? For one, Franklin might have seen how destructive the agreements he'd made with Celeste were, and this might have saved many other people, and Franklin and Celeste, a great deal of pain. More to the point, he might have been able to go to Ruby and say, I'm feeling jealous. I realize that our relationship is constricted, and Newton does not have these limitations. Do you still value our relationship, even as circumscribed as it is? What do I offer you? And what do you value in me? How can we make sure we build a foundation that means you will continue to want to be with me? And the outcome would probably have been very different. It's so easy to pin responsibility for our emotions on other people. You're making me feel this terrible thing. Stop doing that! We forget that our emotions might be the result of our own insecurities rather than our partner's actions. When we transfer responsibility for our emotions to others, we yield control over our own lives. Confronting jealousy. It's okay to feel jealous. That might sound strange in a book about polyamory, but we, the authors of this book, have been there. Almost everyone you meet has been there. Being immune to jealousy is not a prerequisite for polyamory, and feeling jealous doesn't make you a bad poly person. So take a deep breath. Like all feelings, jealousy is not the sum of who you are. It won't kill you, even if it feels like it might. It doesn't necessarily mean something's wrong with you or with your relationship. Even when you're feeling jealous, you're still in control. Jealousy is like that creepy guy sitting behind the king, whispering in his ear. The ambassador has just insulted you most grievously, Your Grace. Attack his lands at once. Raise his villages. But remember, you're still the king. You don't have to set the world on fire and run off to live in a cave, no matter how satisfying that sounds. Here's Franklin's story.
About the time I was involved with Ruby, I had a friend who had a pet iguana, a huge green lizard more than 4 feet long. It was usually docile and friendly, but a pattern would play out every time she took it out of its cage. She would open the cage door and reach inside, and it would lash at her with its whip-like tail. She would jump back, then reach in the cage again. The second time, it would calmly climb up her arm to sit on her shoulder. One day, when I watched her go through this ritual, she said, "I wish it would hit me with its tail just once, so I wouldn't have to be afraid of it anymore." In the aftermath of my relationship with Ruby, I was heartbroken. I spent long nights thinking about what had happened and wondering where our relationship, which had been such a source of joy for both of us, had gone so horribly wrong. Eventually, I realized an inescapable truth. Our relationship had been destroyed because I destroyed it. It wasn't destroyed by her new relationship with Newton. It wasn't destroyed by anything she had done to me. I had destroyed it because I had felt something I believed myself incapable of feeling, and therefore couldn't handle when I did. She had been absolutely right to end the relationship with me. In the blindness of my own pain, I had been completely unaware of the pain I was causing her. The things I felt during and after my relationship with Ruby were the worst I have ever felt in my life, and I didn't ever want to feel them again. And gradually I realized something else. I didn't have to. The secret of not ever feeling this way again was right in front of me. It had been all along. First, after she broke up with me, I learned something valuable. I could lose someone, and I might want to curl up and die, but it wouldn't actually kill me. I knew what it felt like for the lizard to get me, and I didn't have to be afraid of it anymore. I would survive. I could even, eventually, be happy again. Second, I realized she had the right to leave me. Everyone has the right to leave me. Whether they choose to leave me is something I have some control over by the way I treat them. Ruby left because I did things that hurt her, and that drove her away. But it was within my power to do different things. It was not the hand of fate or the uncaring stars. It was the choices I made. If I had made different choices, if I had made decisions that drew my partners closer rather than pushing them away, I might have had a better outcome. The implications of this idea took a long time to sink in. When they did, I felt empowered. Breakups weren't something that just happened to me. They happened because of the choices I and my partners both made. I might feel pain again, but I knew there was something on the other side, and I didn't have to be afraid anymore. I would have a hand in what happened to me.
As Franklin's painful breakup and subsequent epiphany demonstrate, jealousy can be confronted, dealt with, and banished back to the dark places where it slinks, powerless to damage your calm. Don't be discouraged. It might take work to get there, and some of that work might be uncomfortable. Jealousy is a feeling, not an identity. You may feel jealous, but that doesn't make you a jealous person. It's an important distinction. If you say, "I'm a jealous person," you may find it hard to think about letting go of jealousy. It feels like letting go of something that makes you who you are. On the other hand, if you say, "I'm a person who sometimes feels jealous," that gives space to your other emotions. I'm a person who sometimes feels jealous, and sometimes feels happy, and sometimes sad, excited, afraid, angry, or confused. Such a statement reinforces to yourself that jealousy is not who you are. Remember, this too shall pass. When we are buried armpit deep in an emotion, we can find it extraordinarily difficult to remember that emotions are transient. When we're sad, we can be hard put to remember what it's like to be happy. And when we're jealous, we can find it hard to remember what it feels like not to be that way. But there is another way to feel, even if we can't emotionally access it at the moment. Myla's story. When Myla fell in love with Morgan, a polyamorous man, she didn't really know what she was in for, but she knew it would be work. Morgan was already in a relationship with Nina when he started the relationship with Myla, and he started another new relationship not long after. The first few months were hard for Myla. She didn't know where Morgan's relationship with her or his other partners would end up. Morgan's commitment to her was solid, but her clarity on the future was not. She had never been insecure or jealous before, and she had a hard time accepting herself for feeling this way. She didn't know when the jealousy would hit her or what would trigger it. Sometimes it was Morgan and Nina's public displays of affection. Sometimes it was when they attended events as a couple. But the feelings often overwhelmed her. She was motivated to make a poly relationship work, though. Not just by her feelings for Morgan and his steady support for her, but by her own disillusionment with monogamy after an ex had cheated on her, and her belief that doing the work would lead them to a healthier relationship in the long run. So she hung on, and Morgan repeatedly created space for Myla to process her feelings and work on herself. He reassured her that it was okay to feel what she felt, and did not try to fix her feelings for her. Sometimes jealousy triggers come as a complete surprise, which is why trying to prevent your partners from doing things that trigger jealousy doesn't work. The triggers and the underlying causes are quite often different. So lasting relief from jealousy involves digging beneath the triggers to the roots. One strategy for dealing with jealousy looks like this. Step 1. Accept the feelings. You can't deal with jealousy by wishing it away or by shaming yourself. Our emotions are what they are, and telling yourself, I shouldn't feel this way, won't work. When you look around at the polyamorous community, it can be easy to convince yourself that everyone else has conquered their jealousy. And you're not a good poly person if you still feel it. That absolutely isn't true. Very few people say they never felt it, and frankly, we suspect that just means they haven't felt it yet. Accept that there's nothing wrong with you for feeling this way. Step 2. Separate triggers from causes. The next step is harder. It involves disassembling the jealousy to find those places where you are afraid and insecure. Long-lasting jealousy management can come only from strengthening the places where your self-esteem is weak. Examine your triggers, the specific thoughts, actions, sights, or events that set off an emotion. It's easy to believe that these triggers cause the emotion, but the truth is a bit more complicated. We might feel that wild rush of jealousy when we see our partner kiss another person, but that doesn't mean the kiss itself is the root cause. Instead, it's more accurate to say that the kiss is the switch that turns on a complicated chain of emotions that brings us nose to claw with some internal beast, a fear of being replaced, maybe, or a sense of territoriality. The kiss might be the trigger, but the cause is something else, some inner insecurity stirred from its slumber. This chain reaction is why restrictions on specific actions or behaviors rarely do much to alleviate jealousy. The beast still lies there, waiting for some other poke or prod to awaken it. At some point, if we are to be free of jealousy, we have to confront the monster directly. That means digging deep to uncover and deal with the internal things. The wobbles in our sense of worthiness, the little fears that try to convince us we will be abandoned. Step 3. Understand the feelings. Feelings need to be examined to be understood. And the first step in examining them is to accept them for what they are. But that doesn't necessarily mean we have to believe them. We're often told to trust our intuition and go with our gut. But your feelings often lie to you. For example, if you're afraid of snakes, you might feel panic at the sight of a harmless corn snake crossing your path. The fear is genuine, but the thing it's telling you, this snake is a threat to me, is not true. Learning what our feelings are rooted in, without assuming that what they say is always true, is the place to start. Almost always, jealousy is rooted in some sort of fear, of abandonment, of being replaced, of losing the attention of someone you love, of being alone. Jealousy isn't really about the person you feel jealous of. It's about you, your feeling that you might lose something precious. What is it saying? What's the outcome you're afraid will happen? Getting to the roots of your jealousy takes time. When you feel jealous, you often want to act on it immediately, usually in destructive ways. Instead, take the time to figure out what's actually going on, what your jealousy is trying to tell you. Step 4. Talk about it. Jealousy management relies on calming fears directly, by talking about them and learning the way our partners feel about us. The first thing to do when jealousy arises is to talk about it directly. And by talk about it, we don't mean what Franklin did in his relationship with Ruby when he said, "You terrible person, how could you make me feel this way?" We mean acknowledge and own the fear and ask for support to deal with it. When you're on a date with him and you do that thing with your tongue, "I feel jealous. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but I sure could use some love and support." This kind of communication is not always easy, especially when the jealousy arrives with the heaping side order of shame and doubt. Talking about it, though, can go a long way toward pulling out its fangs. One of the best ways to start addressing our fears in poly relationships is to ask our partners what they value in us and trust that what they say is true. And if what they say doesn't stick, ask again and listen and keep at it until those things that make us magnificent in our partner's eyes start to sink in. Step 5. Practice security. A particularly insidious thing about insecurity is that it tends to find or invent evidence to support itself. It sneaks up on you to whisper in your ear that you're not valued and not loved, and your partner doesn't really want to be with you. Even when those things aren't true, these things feel real. There is always the possibility that they are real, But regardless of whether they're real or not, it can be very difficult to tell whether you're actually in danger of being abandoned. Again, we became good at what we practice. When we practice convincing ourselves that our partners don't want us, don't value us, and really don't want to be involved with us, we become good at believing it. When we practice convincing ourselves that we have value and worth and our partners treasure us, we become good at believing that. And often a relationship becomes what we believe about it. If you believe your partner does not love you and treasure you, then you may act in destructive ways. You might become withdrawn, sullen, or defensive, which will cause your relationship to suffer. If you believe you are cherished and valued, then you start to act with confidence, trust, and openness. And people like that are great to be around. Your relationship will blossom. When you feel left out. How do you deal with feeling lonely and left out when your partner is off on a date with someone else? This is a question Franklin gets often in emails. The answer is, perhaps, not intuitive. It's not necessary to feel lonely and left out. This is more obvious when we aren't talking about polyamory. For example, what would we say to someone who says, "I feel lonely and left out for the 8 hours a day my partner is at work"? We might think that was a little strange. Our social values tell us it's okay for our partners to leave us for big chunks of time for work, for errands, for military service, for all sorts of things. Yet we still tend to assume that if a partner is left behind for another romantic relationship, the natural response is to feel alienated and alone. Of course, it's not only romantic relationships that trigger these feelings. Many people feel left out when their partners go to the bar with drinking buddies or join a roller derby league. As if we have two classes of activities, those where we don't expect to feel left behind, such as work or school, and those where we do, such as a date or derby night. It's as though we expect to feel left out when our partner is engaged in a social activity, but not if a partner is engaged in a more mundane task. So really, the feeling isn't about a partner doing something without us. Only certain kinds of activities, usually involving social situations, make us feel this way. Maybe this is because being in a romantic relationship carries social status. Maybe it's because we don't mind missing out on mundane activities, but don't want to miss out on enjoyable ones. The solution might be to build your own hobbies and social circles, so you don't have to rely on your partner to provide for all your social needs. Or maybe the feelings come from a sense of exclusion. If a partner is building a relationship with his fishing buddies, are we being rejected? The solution to this might be to work on your sense of self-worth, as discussed in Chapter 4. Another fear closely related to the fear of being left out is the fear of playing second fiddle. Perhaps your partner is starting a new relationship, and maybe you aren't really being left behind, but you aren't number one focus anymore either. This, too, isn't just a problem in polyamory. You can now become second fiddle to a new child or grandchild, to a new job, to a new hobby. Hell, Franklin has seen someone whose partner became second fiddle to a pet. It was a very cute cat, mind, but still. Again, the central issue is, how much do you trust your partner? If she wants to make you a priority, she will. If she doesn't, she won't. The type of relationship you're in doesn't matter. Every relationship has a natural ebb and flow. Sometimes we do get supplanted, at least for a time. At least for a time in our partner's attentions. When Franklin's partner Amber started working on her master's thesis, Franklin lost some of her focus and attention. When a new baby comes along, we don't find it at all surprising when the baby becomes the center of everything. When these things happen, we trust the time will come when we are priority again. We understand that things happen that require more attention, and that's a part of life. There is a balance. We merely need to have faith in our worth, in our partner's love for us, and in our ability to ask for things when we need to reassure ourselves that the pendulum will swing back and the balance will be restored. Keeping score. Keeping score will drive you insane. Don't do it. If you start counting the nights or dollars spent together, the sexual acts engaged in, the hours on the phone, or anything else of value to compare it with what you're getting, believe us when we say that no good can come of this. You may be somewhat reassured if you come out ahead. But all keeping score will do is make you, your partners, and their partners crazy and bitter without meeting the needs you're trying to get met. Audrey's story. After years of struggling with Jasmine's concerns over losing Joseph's time, Audrey and Joseph began using a spreadsheet. For 2 years, they used it to track the time they spent together, what scheduled time they had missed, what unscheduled time they added. It tracked hours spent and lost, and whether Joseph had spent time with Audrey and Jasmine individually or together as family time. Time on the phone was logged in its own category. Their intention was to reassure Jasmine that their relationship wasn't growing outside of her comfort zone. But all of this record-keeping didn't help anyone. Jasmine preferred to count only time that Joseph and Audrey added over and above their regularly scheduled time, a lunch, coffee date, or vacation day now and then, in keeping with her fear that Joseph's relationship with Audrey was getting too big. Part of Joseph and Audrey's intent in using the spreadsheet was also to show the subtractions, dates, that were missed. This was to help demonstrate that despite Jasmine's fears that they were growing, when you did both the addition and subtraction, they were actually staying small. However, the spreadsheet did not assuage Jasmine's fears. Joseph and Audrey are no longer keeping the spreadsheet, but Jasmine is still counting time. If someone is keeping score, it's generally because they're afraid of something. The problem with using a scorecard to try and assuage that fear is that it does nothing to get to the root of it. Even an even scorecard is unlikely to diminish the fear, as Audrey's story illustrates. Information, by itself, almost never changes feelings. If feeling secure in your relationship is contingent on seeing a certain balance on the scorecard, then you will always be comparing your relationship with another, rather than focusing on what is meaningful in your relationship, what your partner finds of value in you. Taken to its conclusion, keeping scores creates a relationship where people don't state their needs. They barter for what they want, using other people as the bartering chips. And this is a way of treating people as things. People are not interchangeable. Buried in the idea of building relationships by choice rather than by default is a powerful way to combat jealousy. All too often, our relationships do happen by default. We find the best person we can, whatever best means, and then stick that person into the relationship slot. Sometimes, when we do this, we keep half an eye out for someone better to come along. This approach to relationships is based on a tacit assumption that people are interchangeable. If you have a relationship with Zoe and Bridget is hotter and richer, then you can replace Zoe with Bridget and you climb the ladder. This approach leads to insecurity. If Zoe knows that she can be replaced by Bridget, Zoe won't ever feel secure. The idea that people are interchangeable is fundamentally flawed. When we value the things that make our partners who they are, no one person can ever replace another. This is one place where that leap of faith to believe in our own worthiness really pays off. When we feel ourselves worthy of love in our own right, not for the things we do or how we look, but because of who we are, we become more able to recognize our own unique irreplaceability and the irreplaceability of our partners. When we believe ourselves to be worthy, we more easily see our partners as worthy too. Many people in the polyamorous community say that comparisons are poisonous to poly relationships. Don't compare one lover to another, they say. If you do that, you'll breed insecurity. We'd like to suggest, perhaps counterintuitively, this is not necessarily so. Some comparisons are damaging. Raj is better in bed than Franco is, for example, or perhaps Bridget is hotter than Zoe. But there's a different kind of comparison, and that is noticing differences in a way that helps you remain aware of what makes everyone unique. That kind of comparison, which is more about treasuring the things that make people who they are than about ranking people, is awesome, because it reminds us that people are not interchangeable. Remembering that people are not interchangeable can go a long way towards calming the fear of being replaced. Separating reality from falsehood. Believing the best of your partner isn't always easy, and devils lurk in the details. Every now and then you might find yourself in a relationship that is genuinely unhealthy, or with a partner who really does have one foot out the door. It's hard to sort out that from your own insecurities and determine what is true if you don't have a strong self-esteem to begin with. There are no hard rules for distinguishing a situation where your insecurity is whispering falsehoods at you and a situation where your jealousy is a genuine signal of a painful truth. But there are external signs to look for. One sign is a lack of empathy or compassion. A partner who brushes off your fears or isn't willing to talk to you about your jealousy may be telling you that she's looking to leave you for better options. If your partners want to support you, they will listen to your fears, even when they're irrational. What does your partner do when you say, "Honey, I have this fear"? Does she listen with compassion? Does she empathize with your feelings, even if she thinks they're not grounded in fact? If she has done something that hurts you, does she feel genuinely sorry for it? Is she willing to take responsibility for it and make amends? Another sign is an attitude of entitlement. This can be hard to call because your partners are independent adults carrying their own needs and feelings, and they really are entitled to make their own choices. But are they willing to work with you to hear your complaints and to make choices that support you in the long run, even if you may not get everything you want in the short run? As we discuss in chapter 14, it may not be reasonable to restrict your partners to avoid dealing with your insecurities, but sometimes it is reasonable to ask your partners to help you, or even in extreme cases, to agree to temporary and limited restrictions to give you the space that you need. What do your partners say when you ask for reassurance? If you ask for concrete reminders of how your partners love and value you, do you get them? And what does the relationship itself have to say? If we've been involved with someone for 3 months and already they seem restless and distracted, that might be cause for concern. But if we've been with someone for years and we still wake every morning feeling that this is the day they will hopscotch out of our life, then maybe what we're feeling is more about our own insecurity than about our partner's desire to leave. Questions to ask yourself. When you've answered the questions below, you can start asking yourself why you feel the way you do. For example, let's say you answer yes to the question, "Am I worried that someone better comes along? My partner will realize I'm not good enough and want to replace me." That might mean that your self-esteem is not high enough for you to recognize that your partner wants to be with you because he values and cherishes you. Some part of you may be thinking, "Well, I'm not as good as he thinks I am, so I better keep him away from other people. Otherwise, he'll dump me in a heartbeat." The antidote to those feelings is to build a sense of worthiness and understand what it is about yourself that your partner values. Or say you answer yes to the question, "Do I believe that I am not my partner's only sexual partner? I'm not special anymore." The remedy there is to understand the value in a relationship comes from who you are, not what you do. So if your partner has the same experience with another person that he has with you, the feeling of that experience is different because nobody else is you. Am I worried that if someone better comes along, my partner will realize I'm not good enough and want to replace me? Am I uncertain about the value my partner sees in me? Am I not sure why my partner wants to be with me? Does the idea of my partner having another lover mean that whatever my partner sees in me will no longer be valid, or that my partner will want to choose that other lover over me? Do I feel that most other people are sexier, more good-looking, more worthwhile, funnier, smarter, or just generally better than I am, and I am not able to compete with them? Do I believe that if I am not jealous, I don't really love my partner? Do I think that if my partner falls in love with another person, he will leave me for that person? Do I think that if my partner has sex with someone better in bed than I am, she won't want to have sex with me anymore or won't need me anymore? Is sex the glue that holds our relationship together? If my partner has sex with someone else, do I think the relationship will come unglued? Do I believe that other people are willing to do sexual things that I'm not willing to do, and therefore my partner will like having sex with them better? Am I afraid that if my partner has sex with someone else, she will start comparing me whenever we have sex? Am I afraid that anyone my partner has sex with will try to persuade her to leave me? Part 3. Poly Frameworks. 9. Boundaries. Daring to set boundaries is about having the courage to love ourselves, even when we risk disappointing others. Brené Brown. When we create relationships, we invite other people deep into our hearts. We allow them intimate access to our minds, our body, and our emotions. This intimacy is one of the most wonderful, most profoundly transformative things life has to offer. It changes who we are. It tells us that in all the vastness of the universe, we do not have to be alone. But it comes at a price. When we allow others into our heart, and they allow us into theirs, we become exquisitely vulnerable to each other. The people we choose to let in have the power to bring us incredible joy and to hurt us deeply. If we are to respect the gifts of intimacy we are offered, we have an ethical obligation to treat one another with care. In practice, this can be hard. Even when we allow only one person to affect us so deeply, there's a balance to be struck between allowing our partner to be who he is and creating a framework where we feel safe. When more than one person has access to our heart, this balancing act becomes much more complicated and scary. Here, in part 3, we suggest frameworks we can use to create safety and security while still respecting the humanity and autonomy of the people we love. Just as part 2 began with a chapter about ourselves, so does part 3. Because secure polyframeworks begin with ourselves and our boundaries. First, let's explain what we mean by that word, boundaries. Many people use the terms rules, agreements, and boundaries interchangeably. But these terms have subtle, different meanings. And being clear about those distinctions can cut through Gordian knots in relationships. Any discussion of these three words has to start with boundaries, because boundaries are about you and yourself. Understanding boundaries is essential to understanding what kinds of rules and agreements might maximize your happiness, empowerment, and sense of well-being. More on those in the next chapter. Having poor personal boundaries can be damaging to the self. Strong boundaries are vital to building healthy relationships. Boundaries are also essential to consent, and relationships are healthy only when they are consensual. Defining boundaries. Boundaries concern yourself. What you alone own and others may access only with your permission. Because boundaries are personal, we often don't realize where they are until they are crossed. But we can divide personal boundaries into two rough categories. Physical, your body, your sexuality, and mental, your intimacy, your emotions, your affection. Most people, unless they have suffered abuse, have a good sense of where their physical boundaries are. These begin where we feel physically affected by another person. For most of us, they begin a little away from our physical edges, in what we call our personal space. When we set physical boundaries, we are exercising our right to decide if, how, and when